your patch.
I don't see what the law of probability's got to do with it.
Adric.
Good day. Hello. Hi. Welcome to That's Great, Adric, a Doctor Who podcast. I'm your host, Shawnee Wan Kenobi, and this is the second episode. Last episode, we didn't have a title. We came up with the title as the episode was posted, and That's Great, Adric. That's the title of this podcast, until I decide to change it, which I reserve the right, as it is my podcast. But I don't think I will. I kind of like that title. Adric being a child companion of the Fourth Doctor and the Fifth Doctor from the classic series. And to my understanding, a rather annoying child actor to work with. And from what I've seen, a pretty annoying character as well. He was involved in some really good stories. He was just fucking annoying. So when I say, "That's great, Adric," I'm saying it sarcastically. That's great, Adric. Fucking super Adric. That's great. Anyway, that's what we're doing. That's the name of the podcast for now. This being the second episode, we are going to focus on the Doctor Who writer for the month of March. March 2017, the month that I marry the love of my life, Carolyn. We are getting married at the end of the month. So I'm actually kind of surprised that I had time to record this at all. But when I get committed to something, I am committed to something. News, news, news. What's going on with Doctor Who? We are getting closer and closer to Season 10. Series 10. A Time for Heroes seems to be the subtitle. And I don't know that I really like that all that much. But a new trailer just dropped. Quick one. I think it's like 60 seconds long. But to describe it in one word, based on seeing it only once, colorful. It's a new energy, and I don't know if it's good or bad, but there's a new energy with this series, and it's kind of a shame. I spoke to this last week, as far as Peter Capaldi and the 12th Doctor. Every moment he's on the screen, I can't help but be fixated on what Peter Capaldi is doing. I'm not saying that he's a master actor. I'm not saying that he's the perfect Doctor, but he's a pro, and he's passionate about the material and the character. And I don't think that he got a fair shake. I'm not going to go into this again. I went into it last week, and I'm sure I'll go into it again at some point down the road as we draw closer to his regeneration into whoever the 13th Doctor will be. But I get a vibe from that trailer that the 12th Doctor is a little bit darker, a little bit scarier, a little more unhinged than he already has been, without Clara Oswald to anchor him down. Not to go into Clara, not to go into a whole big thing about Series 8 and Series 9. I loved both those series. I thought they were phenomenal. 9 especially. But I'm excited for Series 10. A new companion. The Doctor being seen through new eyes. And I guess even bigger news than the new trailer is the old Cybermen. 2017 is the 50th anniversary of the Cybermen. Top tier Doctor Who monster. Probably the second most well-known Doctor Who monster. Next to the Daleks, obviously. Returning for the two-part Series 10 finale are the Mondasian Cybermen, which were the original Cybermen from the 10th Planet, the last First Doctor story. William Hartnell just could not keep going. He was an old man when he took the role of the Doctor, and his mind was just going, getting worse and worse, forgetting lines. And I think by the time of the 10th Planet, I don't think he was even in the story at all. I think he was sick, dying, and at the end of the 10th Planet, he regenerates into the second Doctor. I might be making that up because I've never seen it, but the Mondasian Cybermen were the featured monster for the 10th Planet. The 10th Planet was I believe it was a sister planet to Earth that came out of nowhere, and the Mondasians were human-like and taken over by Cybermen. That's the best way I can describe it, but I'll try and post a picture. It's incredible how good it looks. It's basically the same costume from the 10th planet from 50 years ago. And to see them in bright 2017 color, it totally works. And I fucking love it. It's awesome. I'm really going to try and post a photo of these Mondasian Cybermen. But you've probably seen them by now. They're not going to be the only monster for the two-part Series 10 finale. I would think that modern-day Cybermen would also be a part of the finale. Mondasian Cybermen, two-part finale for Series 10. Three new Doctor Who books, all featuring the 12th Doctor and the new companion, Bill Potts, who is not a dude named Bill, but actually a young lady named Bill. Three new Doctor Who books are all being released on April 20th to coincide with Series 10. Diamond Dogs, Plague City, The Shining Man. And I can't imagine that these books are very long, but Diamond Dogs is written by Mike Tucker. Plague City is written by Jonathan Morris. And The Shining Man sounds like it's going to be a scary one, written by Kevin Scott. All three feature the 12th Doctor and Bill Potts. And Plague City also features Nardole. And even though Peter Capaldi's run must come to an end, well, it doesn't have to, he's making the decision. Hopefully, he's making the decision, and there's no outside weight or stress being put on him to make that decision. But it's good to know that his character, his Doctor, will live on much the same way the 10th and the 11th and the 9th and the 8th and all these Doctors are still going in book form, audio adventure, comic book. It's a beautiful thing about Doctor Who. The stories never end. The Series 10 premiere will be in U.S. cinemas. I don't know how I feel about that. The Day of the Doctor was in U.S. cinemas, and that was awesome. I didn't see it, but I wish I had. And I know that the Series 8 premiere, Deep Breath, Peter Capaldi, first story as the Doctor, that was in cinemas. And I get that. The first story for a Doctor is always kind of like a soft reboot of the series. I don't know. The Series 10 premiere in cinemas, it just seems kind of like a cash grab. April 17th and April 19th of 2017. U.S. cinema outing for series premiere of Series 10. Fathom Events are planning to show this year's series premiere of Doctor Who in cinemas across the United States on the 17th and 19th of April. And it will include additional features. What did we say was the name of the Series 10 premiere? We went over this last week, and you would think that I would know. A Star in Her Eye, or Stars in Her Eye, or... But you get the Series 10 premiere, you get episode 1 of the spin-off series Class, which... Did we talk about Class last week? I don't think we did. I meant to. But it's just, there's only so much time. It's going to start with Series 10, and I will check it out, and I will comment on it. We'll also get the never-before-seen bonus feature, Becoming the Companion. Trying to sell Bill on us. And you gotta wonder if Bill is going to stick around after PCAPS takes a hike. New showrunner, new Doctor. May as well have a new companion. Who knows? We don't know what Bill's gonna be like. And she may be incredibly popular. We'll get news on that soon enough, I would think. What else is going on in the news? Neil Fingleton has died. He played the Fisher King in Before the Flood. And the Fisher King was not as frightening as I thought he would be, but he was pretty cool. And Neil Fingleton is just a really tall, or he was a really tall guy. 7'6". He's actually in the Guinness Book of World Records as the tallest British-born man. Being the tallest British-born man, the Fisher King was not the only tall role that he played. He also played Mag the Mighty in Game of Thrones. He played, I don't know who, but he was in X-Men First Class, and he was in Avengers Age of Ultron. I think he was like a basketball player. Obviously, at 7'6", he was a basketball player, and he got injured, and he turned to acting, and he was in all this great science fiction stuff. But he's dead. He had a heart attack, and it should be noted. Well, this just in. Star in Her Eye is not the name of the Series 10 premiere episode. It's going to be called The Pilot. Interesting. Or is it? I don't know. It could be one of those fucking Stephen Moffat things. He calls it The Pilot, as in the first episode of a TV series is generally called the pilot episode. So he may be doing some kind of stupid meta thing, thinking he's clever, like the Doctor. And he is, but he's more clever when he's not trying to be clever. I don't know if I mentioned John Hurt 2 weeks ago, whatever it was. It would have been old news at that point in time. John Hurt passed away from pancreatic cancer, which is just, that's the quickest way to go by cancer. It's pancreatic cancer. Horrible. Kills you so quick. And Sir John Hurt, knighted by the Queen of England, he's had a long film career. 1984, The Elephant Man, Alien, and in recent years, he was in the Harry Potter series. He was in Hellboy. He's done voice acting for great science fiction fantasy stuff. Lord of the Rings, the animated movie from the 80s or 70s or some shit. Watership Down. Classic Watership Down. And The Black Cauldron. John Hurt played the War Doctor in The Day of the Doctor. And you know that. If you listen to this podcast, you know about The Day of the Doctor. Moffat's original intent with The Day of the Doctor was Christopher Eccleston to have that role. Him to have been the one that destroyed the Time Lords and the Daleks. But Christopher Eccleston did not want anything to do with Doctor Who after series one of the modern series, for whatever his reason. Stephen Moffat had to come up with something that packed the same punch as having the 10th, 11th, and 9th Doctor sharing the screen. He created a new Doctor. Fuck it. We always thought there was 11 Doctors. He just added another Doctor. This Doctor, he was called the War Doctor. The 8th Doctor regenerates into the War Doctor. And the War Doctor is the one that fights in the Time War. It's interesting that when Paul McCann's 8th Doctor regenerates into the War Doctor, it seems like he's a very young man. And then when we see John Hurt in The Name of the Doctor, the Series 7 finale leading into The Day of the Doctor, he's John Hurt, this older, grizzled, beaten character. His chemistry with Matt Smith and David Tennant was perfect. A lot of people are saying The Day of the Doctor is the greatest Doctor Who story of all time. And I could understand why they say that now, but it's not. It is for now because it's so fresh in everybody's mind. And it was amazing story. How much they fit in. Easter eggs, callbacks, getting every Doctor in there. Stephen Moffat set out to write a epic Doctor Who story that would do justice to 50 years of Doctor Who. And he did just that. And I can forgive how sloppy Series 7 of Doctor Who was, because I know that most of his energy and focus was on the 50th anniversary story, which is, bottom line, the most important thing that Stephen Moffat has ever done in his career. That's obviously not knocking him. Sir John Hurt was just a piece of The Day of the Doctor, that one of the many pieces that if that character didn't work, the story wouldn't have worked. Everything just landed perfectly for The Day of the Doctor, and it started with casting John Hurt as an unknown Doctor, and he just fit right in. So John Hurt, rest in peace, my friend. Very sad. A Doctor has died. What other news before we get to the topic at hand for today, which is Mr. Mark Gatiss, our writer of the month for March. I wanted to talk about the Doctor Who comic books. I don't know much about secondary Doctor Who stories, meaning novelizations, original novels, audio stories. I have an 8th Doctor adventure, which the reason I got it was supposed to be one of the best Big Finish Doctor Who audio adventures. Bright Eyes, right? I think it's called Bright Eyes. Or is that the fucking... I have Watership Down in my head now. The 8th Doctor range of Big Finish. Big Finish is a company that creates audio stories, and they have the rights to Doctor Who. During the Wilderness years, which were the years between Survival, the final classic Doctor Who story, and Rose, the Return of Doctor Who for a modern series, audio stories with the 8th Doctor were what Doctor Who was. Even though Paul McGann has only been on television playing the Doctor twice, the television movie and in the short story, The Night of the Doctor, he is a legit Doctor because of the Big Finish audio adventures. And there's a ton of them. BigFinish.com, just if you think you might be interested in a Doctor Who audio adventure, You will be. They're really good. At least the one I listened to was really good. I'd love to listen to another one, but it's... they do get kind of pricey. Okay. I'm going to search for Bright Eyes, but I don't think that's it. Dark Eyes. Boom, motherfucker. Dark Eyes. You know, Dark Eyes, Dark Eyes 2, Dark Eyes 3. Dark Eyes refers to Molly O'Sullivan. Molly O'Sullivan, who becomes the Eighth Doctor's companion. As far as the comic book goes, and I wanted to talk about comics real quick, not for Doctor Who, but for Torchwood, because there have been rumors created mostly by John Barrowman, Captain Jack, about a possible Torchwood return to television. And if this is something that's going to happen, it's, I mean, no offense to John Barrowman, it's got to happen somewhat soon. He plays an immortal character, but he's really starting to look his age. And it happens. I'm starting to look my age, too. But the character of Captain Jack Harkness is immortal and hasn't aged in like hundreds of years. So, you know, how are you going to explain, not Children of Earth, Miracle Day? How are you going to explain how he looked in Miracle Day, which was a lot older than Children of Earth, however he would look if a new series is commissioned and produced and aired? There's only so much plastic surgery that a person can have. The reason I say all of this, which may sound like just the ramblings of a madman, Titan Comics currently has the license to publish Doctor Who comic books. So there's a 10th Doctor, 11th Doctor, 12th Doctor, and I believe a 9th Doctor series, current ongoing series, a regular monthly series for each of these Doctors. And they also started a Torchwood series. And the Torchwood series is written by John Barrowman himself, I believe with his sister, who he has also written some young adult fiction with. And I'm not sure what... I think it's a like some kind of story about a twin brother and twin sister who have superpowers. Everything that John Barrowman does seems to be like a glorified version of himself. And I'm not knocking him. It just, he does seem like he's kind of full of himself. So Torchwood, its return. No, I'm not quoting John Barrowman. I'm paraphrasing John Barrowman. But basically what he's saying is, if you want to see Torchwood return to TV, buy the Torchwood comic book, because it will show whoever, BBC, Russell T. Davies, Moffat, whoever it is that would be able to air Torchwood, it would show them that there is an interest in Torchwood. So I just wanted to check out the comic book sales of the Doctor Who line and Torchwood. For the month of February, the 10th Doctor ongoing series sold 5,161 copies. The 11th Doctor series sold 5,122 copies. The 12th Doctor series, PCAPS, sold 5,003 copies. Torchwood, issue number 2, sold 4,825 copies. Bummerooski. I would love to see Torchwood come back. And even though it's hard to picture what the Torchwood team would look like and why they would get back together, I still like the character of Captain Jack. I've never been a big Gwyn Cooper fan, but I'd like to see her return also. Would the team feature Rex from Miracle Day, who now is immortal like Captain Jack? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they'd have to explain it, but to my understanding, what I've seen of the comic book series is it's a direct continuation. So, a lot of people like to say that Torchwood ended with Series 3 when Ianto died. And everybody loves Ianto, and everybody wants Ianto and Jack Harkness to live happily ever after. But Ianto is killed in Children of Earth, which, say what you will about Torchwood, Children of Earth is quite possibly five of the greatest hours of British television I've ever seen. It's an amazing, amazing miniseries, and that's how Torchwood should have worked from the get-go. I mean, the first two series with the standalone stories, some were real good, some were pretty fucking bad. But Children of Earth, a 5-part miniseries, which I believe aired Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday in 1 week. It's just amazing television. You can find it on Amazon Prime. And if you haven't seen Torchwood, I suggest you maybe skim through the first two series. You know, I could come up with a list of which ones you should watch, which ones you can skip. But Children of Earth is something, even just as a Doctor Who fan, is something that you want to watch, something you want to experience. Russell T. Davies, at the end of his run with Doctor Who also, it kind of all coincides together, Children of Earth, the specials year with David Tennant, leading into the end of Time Part 1 and 2. Just that time, the uncertainty for the property of Doctor Who, leading to Stephen Moffat's era. Children of Earth fits right in with everything that was going on at that time. But unfortunately, 4,000 comic books is not going to greenlight a fifth series of Torchwood. And I mean that, unfortunately, it is not. But Mark Gatiss is the subject for today. That was the news, and now we will discuss Mark Gatiss as soon as we come back from this little musical interlude.
I'm just saying that a lot of the time you don't really make sense. Well, now I'll never know if I was right.
Hello, hi, welcome back.
How can you tell which is which?
That's great, Adric. Just wonderful. A Doctor Who podcast. Shawnee Wong Kenobi, your host. Me. Mark Gatiss, writer of the month for That's Great, Adric. The Doctor Who podcast starring me, Shawnee Wong Kenobi. Why did I choose Mark Gatiss as the writer to take a look at this month? The man is a far better writer than I am. He has a very successful career. But the reason I chose Mark Gatiss is because he has somehow positioned himself into the Doctor Who production team. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you think about this current run of Doctor Who, and you think of Stephen Moffat, Peter Capaldi, and Mark Gatiss is right there with him. And if that's good or if that's bad, I don't know. I mean, I really enjoyed Series 8. I really enjoyed Series 9. Mark Gatiss is right there with Stephen Moffat. And this is a few times now that these two have teamed up together and written something that is pretty freaking good. Mark Gatiss is from a working class family, born in Sedgefield, England. And he grew up by a psychiatric hospital, the Edwardian Psychiatric Hospital of Sedgefield. And his father worked at this hospital. And as a young man, as a young boy, Mark loved watching Doctor Who. And he also really loved watching Hammer Horror, which is a British production company that made films like Curse of Frankenstein and Dracula. You know, these would air on whatever Saturday afternoon, and that's how Mark would spend his time. He also read a lot of Sherlock Holmes, and he also collected fossils. And Mark Gatiss got his start in show business as part of a sketch comedy team called The League of Gentlemen, and they aired a sketch comedy show on the radio, and then it was actually on BBC Two, which is kind of surprising, in 1999. And it was a black comedy about a fictional town of Royston Valley or Raston Valley. I'm not sure what I wrote here, but it was a fictional town in England. I think it was like three guys in the League of Gentlemen, Mark Gatiss being one. They all played different characters that lived in this town. And I watched a little bit of it on YouTube. It wasn't all that funny, but it was silly, it's harmless, and it's no better, no worse than a lot of the other British canned laughter comedy shows. Maybe it's a little bit worse. I don't know. Gatiss isn't, I don't think he's like a funny. See, this is the thing with Mark Gatiss. He's not like funny. He's not scary. He's not dramatic. He's just okay at all these things. He's prolific. I want to compare him to Stephen King because Stephen King is a prolific writer, but I can't do that. I don't read Stephen King. Any Stephen King stories that have become movies or been adapted for TV or film, I'm just not the biggest fan of. The Shining, but his version is nothing like the Jack Nicholson, Stanley Kubrick film. After The League of Gentlemen, Gatiss focused on both writing and acting. Some of his credits include Little Britain in 2003, which he wrote for and he appeared in, and Matt Lucas was a part of Little Britain. It was like another sketch comedy show. It actually had an American version, Little Britain USA, on HBO, which sucked. I'm sure Little Britain sucks too, but Matt Lucas was on Little Britain. Matt Lucas, who plays Nardole. He also, as far as acting, he was in the 2005 remake of The Quartermass Experiment, which he just acted in. That was on BBC Four. He wrote and starred in The Worst Journey in the World, which was also on BBC Four. And I guess up until that point, I think that was in 2005, but up until that point, that was kind of his biggest accomplishment. But he did crack BBC One in a new production of The Wind in the Willows, playing Ratty. And I remember The Wind in the Willows as a Disney, I think it was a feature-length cartoon. And I remember I liked it. And I remember that there was a ride at Disney World based on their version of The Wind in the Willows called Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. And I don't know if it's there anymore because the last time I was in Disney World was 1986. Other acting of note for Mark Gatiss, he played Robert Louis Stevenson in Jekyll, which was a pretty high-profile BBC One serial created by Stephen Moffat. So this is the first time that these two worked together, was on Jekyll. And I think Jekyll's on Netflix. It was. I never watched it, but it was on Netflix for a time. He played Malcolm McLaren in a drama about Boy George. And Malcolm McLaren was the creator of the Sex Pistols and just a fucking douchebag. But he owned a clothing store, and he made the Sex Pistols out of, like, just some punk asshole kids that would come in shopping at the store. As far as acting, Gatiss is most well-known as a few different roles. He's probably most well-known as playing Mycroft Holmes in BBC's Sherlock, which he's also the co-creator of with Stephen Moffat. He played Tycho Nestoris in Game of Thrones. He had an appearance in Season 4, Season 5. Gatiss was also in Wolf Hall, which was the series about King Henry VIII and his... Shit, what was that guy's name? I don't know, whatever. King Henry VIII and his court. Gatiss plays Stephen Gardner, who was a secretary to Henry VIII, played by Brody from Homeland. And he's currently playing, which is actually another pretty high-profile television show, Taboo. He's playing Prince Regent George IV in Taboo, which is the series currently airing on FX. I think it's already aired in the UK. I think on the BBC. I'm not sure, but it's the series written by Tom Hardy.
The Fire Rises.
Tom Hardy, and I think like Tom Hardy's brother or Tom Hardy's father also wrote Taboo with Tom Hardy. Total Tom Hardy project. And Gatiss is not writing for it. He's just acting in it, playing Prince Regent George IV. As far as Doctor Who acting, he's had a couple appearances in the modern series of Doctor Who. He's played Professor Lazarus in The Lazarus Experiment, which was a third series story. And he played a guy named Gantok in The Wedding of River Song. Super duper. As far as his writing, which is what we're focusing on, the writing of Mark Gatiss, his highest profile stuff, even more so than Doctor Who, is his work on Sherlock. He created the modern series of Sherlock with Stephen Moffat. It's a modern series. It's modern day telling. The character of Sherlock Holmes was created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and it's, fuck, who knows how long ago, but I mean, I don't know how long ago the character of Sherlock Holmes, or what year that character is supposed to exist, but it's such an old character and such a well-known character in the UK that a lot of British people, probably the same kids that voted for Brexit, they think that Sherlock Holmes was a real British person, a real detective. He's not. He's a fictional character. And the character is so old that it's actually in the public domain. Since 2000, it's been in the public domain in the UK. And if I read this correctly, since 2014, it's been in the public domain in the US. And being in the public domain basically means that anybody can create something with this property for the public. It's a work that's so old, it was created before there were copyrights. So that's why you see Sherlock on BBC and you see Elementary on CBS or whatever the fuck, and you see these stupid Robert Downey Jr. movies. I can go and create a Sherlock Holmes movie if I could get a budget together and can just do it. And it's fine because everybody owns Sherlock Holmes. But Sherlock on BBC is a really high-profile series. In fact, maybe not with Series 4, but Series 3 for sure, it's a higher profile than Doctor Who. In the UK, at least. Benedict Cumberbatch, who just had a starring turn as Doctor Strange, and he was in Star Trek Into Darkness. He played Khan. You guys know who Benedict Cumberbatch is. But his portrayal of Sherlock is the most well-known UK character this past year, 2016. His Sherlock was the most well-known character of UK origin. I think it was worldwide. And second place was The Doctor. It also stars Martin Freeman as Watson and Mark Gatiss. In addition to creating the series with Moffat and writing for it, he also plays Sherlock's older brother, Mycroft Holmes. Mycroft or Minecraft? Whatever the fuck, man. It's early in the morning. Mycroft Holmes. The thing with Sherlock is each episode is given, it's treated like a film. It's got like a 90-minute runtime. So they do three episodes per series. And Series 3 in 2014 was the most watched drama in the UK since 2001. Series 4, which just aired this past year, slipped something like 20%, if I read it correctly. But Series 3, the most watched drama in the UK since 2001. So for Mark Gatiss, that's quite a feat. Congratulations to him. As the co-creator, executive producer, one of the lead writers, each series has, like I said, three episodes. So that's 3, 6, 9, 12 Christmas episodes, so 13 episodes. Of the 13, he's written 6. He wrote The Great Game, which was the Series 1 finale. He wrote The Hounds of Baskerville, which was Series 2, Episode 2. He wrote The Empty Hearse, which was a big one. That was a Series 3 premiere, where we all thought that Sherlock was dead. And we all know he wasn't, but we needed to see how he lived and how he would confront Watson. The Six Thatchers was the Series 4 premiere, which I think was the best of the three that came out with this series. I don't think the other two got such glowing reviews. The Sign of Three, he co-wrote with Moffat and a gentleman named Steve Thompson. And The Abominable Bride, which was the Christmas special. He wrote that with Stephen Moffat. Mark Gatiss' work on Sherlock is stronger than his Doctor Who efforts. Perhaps it's due to time constraints. Doctor Who, you're telling a story in 40 to 50 minutes. Gatiss is not a guy that's getting a two-parter. His stories are just not strong enough. I'm not knocking him. I guess I kind of am knocking him, but Moffat's getting the two-parters. Other than Moffat, you got to have a really good run to get a two-parter. Gatiss is not getting two-parters, so he's only getting 40 minutes to tell a Doctor Who story. Gatiss seems more like he writes somebody else's idea with Doctor Who. He's not coming up with a concept on his own. I think with Sherlock, he has more freedom. And if you remember before, he grew up watching Doctor Who and reading Sherlock. So is it easier to write about a television show that you loved, writing the characters that you put on such a pedestal? Or is it easier to write a television show about a book that you loved? You follow what I'm saying? I would think the latter's a bit easier because your imagination, how you picture it, is more personalized. It's more intimate. Sherlock Holmes existed in Mark Gatiss' mind. I'm sure there were dozens of film adaptations, TV shows, radio dramas about Sherlock Holmes, but they were all with a different spin. Whereas Doctor Who's a property around forever, different doctors, but all basically the same story, the same idea, same portrayal. Plus, he's making more creative decisions. I'm sure that has to do with it also. Gatiss also writes novels. He's written some Doctor Who novels, but he also writes a non-Doctor Who series. And this series is called The Vesuvius Club, and it's had a little bit of success. So Mark Gatiss is prolific. He obviously enjoys the work that he does. And even though his Doctor Who stories are, for the most part, average, he's the kind of guy that swings for the fences with everything he does. Though his work never ends up being amazing. You see the effort, and they all have an energy to them, and a style that you know is Mark Gatiss' style. To say Gatiss has done a solid job on Doctor Who is perhaps an overstatement, but he's put in a strong effort, and he has developed a relationship with Stephen Moffat to the point that Moffat trusts the guy creatively, which for a showrunner, for a show like Doctor Who, where so many people are watching and judging, you know, that kind of trust, that kind of relationship is unusual. In fact, I compare maybe Stephen Moffat and Gatiss' relationship to that of Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat. and I mentioned this before, for the current Doctor Who era, which is the Stephen Moffat post-Matt Smith era, or the Peter Capaldi-Stephen Moffat era, Gatiss has a larger association with the big picture of the series. I would assume that this is due to Sherlock's success, mostly, but also because Mark Gatiss has an incredible knowledge of Doctor Who. He loves the property. So does Stephen Moffat. So does Peter Capaldi. So these three guys are creating the show, but they also love the history of the show, and they love what they're doing. Gatiss is, he's a Doctor Who guy. We're going to take another break. When we get back, we're going to talk about one Mark Gatiss episode in particular. My original plan was to go through every Mark Gatiss episode, and perhaps I will do that as a companion episode to this one, but I think if we just focus on one episode today, we will be better served. So we'll be right back. Enjoy this music interlude.
No! Now look!
That's great, Adric. Hi, hello, welcome back. That's great, Azure. And today we're discussing Mark Gatiss. And Mark Gatiss has written a story for Doctor Who basically every series. Series 1, you had a Mark Gatiss story. Series 2, you had a Mark Gatiss story. But Series 3 and Series 4, you did not. Series 5, Series 6, Series 7, he has 2. Series 8 and Series 9, you have Mark Gatiss episodes. 8. Altogether, which puts him behind Moffat and Russell T. Davies for a number of Doctor Who modern series stories written. Sleep No More from Series 9, which was a found footage Doctor Who story, which I was not excited at all about, and actually aired on my birthday 2 years ago now. It wasn't that bad, and rewatches make it better. Robot of Sherwood from Series 8, which it's a fun romp. It's nothing serious, and I actually enjoyed it. With each rewatch, The Crimson Horror, which was probably one of my favorites from Series 7B. Cold War, also from Series 7B. Pretty crazy that the guy wrote two stories in the second half of Series 7. But I talked about The Day of the Doctor early on in today's episode, and that's the reason why Gatiss had two episodes, because Moffat was focused on The Day of the Doctor. Cold War wasn't such a good episode, but it featured the return of the Ice Warriors, or at least one Ice Warrior. And in his episode for Series 10, Gatiss has already informed us that the Ice Warriors will return again. A new kind of Ice Warrior is how he puts it. And I'm not really super excited about that, but you know what? With the exception of Sleep No More, which isn't even that, it's not even that bad. His body of work for Doctor Who, like I said, it's not strong, it's not outstanding, but it's solid, or just about solid. Night Terrors in Series 6, which was supposed to be a scary story. He does like to write horror, scary Doctor Who stories. Sleep No More, Crimson Horror, Night Terrors. He did The Victory of the Daleks in Series 5, which a lot of people hate, and I don't love. But it's not that bad. He doesn't have a story that's bad. Even Sleep No More, it's not bad. It's not good, it's not pretty good, it's okay. But his two strongest pieces of work for Doctor Who, to be honest with you, perhaps his strongest piece of work for Doctor Who is An Adventure in Space and Time. An Adventure in Space and Time was part of the 50th anniversary celebration, and it's basically a dramatization of the creation of Doctor Who and William Hartnell's run as the Doctor. And it's very entertaining. It focuses on William Hartnell. The ending of the story is pretty meta. It also features Verity Lambert and Sidney Newman and everybody involved with the creation of Doctor Who from the get-go. So that may be his best piece of writing for Doctor Who, An Adventure in Space and Time. But that's not really canon for Doctor Who. It's a dramatization of the work that went into making Doctor Who. And if you haven't seen it, I don't know what y'all are working on, but you gotta go check it out. I think it's on Amazon Prime. As far as straight Doctor Who stories, written by Mark Gatiss, his two strongest are the first two that he wrote. 2006, Series 2, The Idiot's Lantern. and 2005, Series 1, The Unquiet Dead. When I realized the work that went into researching just one of these stories, I decided that I could not go through his entire body of work here and now. I can't do it. It's not enough time. I'm not putting out a 4-hour podcast. So we're going to focus on what I think is his best work. And I'm saying it's his best work because of when the story was written, the purpose for which the story was written, and the end result of the story. So The Unquiet Dead from 2005, Series 1, Episode 3 of the modern Doctor Who series, would have to be Mark Gatiss's crowning achievement in Doctor Who. Story number 163. Directed by Euros Lynn, original air date April 9th, 2005. And the working title for The Unquiet Dead was The Crippingwell Horror. And then it was The Angels of Crippingwell. The Unquiet Dead, story number 163 for Doctor Who, Series 1, Episode 3. This story is set in Victorian-era Cardiff. So during the Victorian age, Charles Dickens is a featured character, and he's played by Simon Callow. Simon Callow is a great actor of the theater and a great director of the theater. This story also features the character of Gwyneth, played by Evie Miles. And Evie Miles would later on play Gwen Cooper. And Gwen Cooper, that character, would actually be part of Gwyneth's lineage. So a couple things in this story play into Torchwood. What's important to keep in mind is that this is the third story for the modern series of Doctor Who. So there's a lot of pressure on Gatiss. And honestly, I don't think that he noticed. I don't think that he let it get to him. I don't think that he's the kind of guy that would let pressure get to him. But the third story, think about that. You know, you have the modern series premiere. Even if it's a dud, people are going to come back for the second story. And even if the second story doesn't work so well, people are still going to come back for the third story. Third time's a charm. But if this story didn't work, then there's problems. Fortunately, Rose seemed to work. The end of the world seemed to work. And perhaps that put a different kind of pressure on the Unquiet Dead to work. The monster of this story is called the Gelth. G-E-L-T-H. And the Gelth are a gaseous alien life form. They are able to enter Cardiff through what's called the Rift. And the Rift will go on to play a big part in Torchwood lore. The Gelth enter through the Rift, which just so happens to run through a funeral parlor owned by a Mr. Sneed. The Gelth take over corpses in the funeral parlor, and it seems like the corpses come back to life. The Doctor and Rose arrive in Cardiff on Christmas 1869, smack dab in the Victorian era, and come across both Charles Dickens and Mr. Sneed. And we have our story. The original version of this story was darker, and it focused more on psychic mediums, people that claim they could connect with the other side, okay? But the story became not quite a fun adventure, not quite a romp, but more adventurous. And instead of focusing on mediums, it focused on corpses, on zombies. Simon Callow, like I said, he was a theater actor. A theater actor and director. And he accepted the role of Charles Dickens because he felt that the character, a historical figure, someone that actually existed, was written accurately. Callow had played Dickens quite a few times before, and he had done a lot of research into Charles Dickens to play those parts. So he's very familiar with Charles Dickens' life, and he felt that the Charles Dickens written for The Unquiet Dead was dead on Dickens. Hashtag dead on Dickens. The Gelth, the CGI that went into creating the Gelth, actually went over budget. So episode 3 and Russell T. Davies is already over budget. It's not like they have to take away from that story. It would just end up robbing effects from later on in the series. But The Unquiet Dead premiered to 8.86 million UK viewers, which was more than Prince William's wedding. Or at least that's what somebody on the internet said. I didn't look that up, but it's nice to think that it was. Russell T. Davies, who was the showrunner, script editor, executive producer of the modern series as it returned. He kind of developed it or redeveloped it for television. Russell T. Davies had the concept for The Unquiet Dead. And with this story, he wanted to establish the range of the new series, right? So Rose, the premiere, took place in modern day. And The End of the World, episode 2, story number 2, took place in the far future. So for the third story to go back in time to the Victorian era, Russell T. Davies felt that that would show the range that the new series could achieve. And his original idea wasn't a whole lot. It wasn't very developed. He wanted Victorian times. He wanted Charles Dickens. And he wanted this story to be about fake mediums claiming they could communicate with the dead. Gatiss took that idea and he set this story in a spiritualist hotel, which would be full of fake mediums, con men. And Mr. Sneed, the character that ends up owning a funeral parlor, he was the original focus and he was a con man, unaware that he was actually a real medium. But what happened was Gwyneth became the more popular character with the production team because of Evie Miles' performance. And this would lead to her career getting started with Torchwood. She took on the medium role that was originally meant for Mr. Sneed. And instead of focusing on mediums, Gatiss decided to focus on the Gelf aspect, the possession, and the corpses being reanimated, almost as zombies. Original ideas for this story also included grim details of Gwyneth's brother's death. So it was a lot darker in tone when Gatiss first got started with it. Gatiss was encouraged by Russell T. Davies and producer Phil Collinson to give a personality to the Gelf. And when I say personality, I don't mean like make them funny, make them charming, give them a voice, give them a life, make them not just gas, a gaseous alien just floating around in the air, but make them talk to the doctor. And the Gelf was a name that just came to Gatiss. He added the Rift to explain the Gelf's origins. And like I said before, the Rift would go on to be a backbone for Torchwood's narrative, whereas Torchwood, the Rift would be their main, but the antagonists would arrive in Cardiff through the Rift. And the Rift all got started with the Unquiet Dead, Mark Gatiss. Originally, Gatiss was very resistant to Dickens being in the story at all. He didn't want to use an actual historical figure, because using an actual historical figure in a show like Doctor Who can be very tricky. But Gatiss gave in to RTD, not that he had a choice, and he actually realized that the narrative of Charles Dickens in The Unquiet Dead mirrored Scrooge McDuck's narrative in Mickey's Christmas Carol, which he found very interesting. Oh wait, no, not Scrooge McDuck. What am I talking about? You know what I mean. Motherfuckers. It's fucking great, Adric. According to Simon Callow, Gatiss knew exactly, and this is, I'm making air quotes, Gatiss knew exactly what Dickens is all about. Gatiss cleverly connects his ideals with the Doctor's desire to save the world. That kind of sounds like Simon Callow is just bullshitting for a press packet. Gatiss did portray Charles Dickens as ill and somewhat beaten, and Callow knew that this was how Dickens was towards the end of his life. And to me, personally, Mark Gatiss seemed to be going for a Talons of Wang Chang feel as far as the tone he used for The Unquiet Dead. There are horror elements to this story, and on rewatches, I find that even though this story occurred so early on in modern Doctor Who, it is actually one of the scariest modern Doctor Who stories. It's not Blink, but it's up there. There's a valid criticism is that Victorian Cardiff is not nearly as dark and sickly as actual Victorian Cardiff was. I'm not a history expert, and I can live just fine with the way Victorian Cardiff was represented in The Unquiet Dead. But some people do have a problem with this. And I don't think that's a Mark Gatiss criticism. I think that'd be more of a Euros Lynn direction criticism. The Gelf were by no means outstanding or memorable. That's okay too. They were serviceable. And the hook of the story wasn't the Gelf themselves. It was the zombie corpses. It was Evie Miles and Charles Dickens. The Gelf needed to be functional and believable. And I think they were. But when I think of this story, especially without reading on it or watching it again, I don't remember the Gelf. But I do remember that it's a creepy story and that I enjoyed it. Being the third story of the modern series, it is somewhat odd that the Doctor and Rose almost take a backseat to the guest stars. And it's not something that hurts the story. It's just somewhat odd. And maybe, it's almost daring, right? Such an important story would go lighter on the Doctor and Companion aspect and focus more on the guest stars. Already the modern series is far different from the classic. The classic series used 4 to 6 to 8 25-minute episodes to tell one story, whereas the modern series is using 1 45 to 50-minute episode to tell a story. So they have less than half the time to tell a story that the classic series had, and this requires a different approach. And I think Gatiss, all things considered, did a phenomenal job telling this story. Going for a classic Doctor Who feel and look, going for a classic Doctor Who tone, and having only half the time to achieve that. It should also be noted that Russell T. Davies, with this episode, wanted to reestablish the TARDIS as having a mind of its own, or not functioning to top performance at all times, basically saying the Ninth Doctor and Rose arrive in Victorian Cardiff completely by accident. The Doctor attempted to pilot the TARDIS to Naples in 1860 to show Rose the past, but instead he ended up in Cardiff in 1869 on Christmas Eve. A funeral parlor in Cardiff, run by Gabriel Sneed and his servant Gwyneth, is having problems with their corpses. And as we see at the beginning of this story, the corpse of Mrs. Peace has been taken over by a blue vapor. She rises from her coffin, kills her grandson, and lurches away from the funeral parlor. Gwyneth is a medium, and she senses that the corpse is going to see Charles Dickens at a nearby theater. There's a lot going on, and somehow Gatiss keeps it all together. In the middle of Charles Dickens' performance, the blue vapor leaves Mrs. Peace and scares the audience away. This commotion attracts the attention of the Doctor and Rose, and they rush over to investigate. Mr. Sneed and Gwyneth arrive and capture the corpse, but they are confronted by Rose, so they end up kidnapping her as well. Dickens, meanwhile, accuses the Doctor of ruining his performance. The Doctor keeps gushing over the literary genius of Charles Dickens until Dickens decides to offer his help to the Doctor. Rose wakes up at the funeral parlor with the newly reanimated corpses of Mrs. Peace and Mr. Redpath. The Doctor and Charles Dickens arrive and break into the parlor just in time to rescue Rose. After hearing about the trouble with the corpses, the Doctor convinces Gwyneth to help him hold a séance to attempt to communicate with the dead. The blue vapors fill the room and they reveal that they are the remains of the Gelph, a once physical alien race that were devastated during the Time War. They plead with the Doctor to open the rift that exists in the basement of the parlor and allow them to cross over. The Doctor offers the Gelph temporary use of the corpses until he can transport them to a place where they can build new bodies, and they can use Gwyneth as a bridge to cross the rift. Gwyneth stands in the middle of an arch and opens the rift, allowing the Gelph to cross over. But the number of Gelph is far greater than anticipated, and their true motive is revealed. They intend to kill the living to give themselves more hosts and take over Earth. One of the reanimated corpses strangles Sneed to death, allowing another Gelph to possess his body. Charles Dickens flees the parlor. Rose and the Doctor are trapped in part of the basement. Outside, Dickens realizes that the beings are affected by gas, and he returns to the house. He extinguishes the gas lights and turns the gas on full, pulling the Gelph out of the bodies. The Doctor tells Gwyneth to send the Gelph back and close the rift, but she cannot close it, and she cannot leave. Instead, she takes out a box of matches, intending to ignite the gas and kill the Gelph along with herself. The Doctor determines that Gwyneth is already dead and that by opening the rift, she has doomed herself. The Doctor, Rose, and Dickens flee the parlor just before it explodes and burns, killing Gwyneth and the Gelph. The Doctor and Rose head back to the TARDIS, and Charles Dickens thanks them for their help. He decides to leave immediately for London to patch up things with his family and to finish the mystery of Edwin Drood. The Doctor and Rose say their goodbyes and take off in the TARDIS. An astounded Charles Dickens walks away through the streets of Cardiff, greeting everyone he passes and quoting a Christmas carol, "God bless us, everyone." Gatiss, initially resistant to including Charles Dickens in this story at all, but then he fully embraces the idea of Charles Dickens in a Doctor Who story. And somehow the whole thing works. Reading the plot, having just watched this story again, there are times when it's loose and fast, particularly at the beginning, but it seems to get tighter as the story goes on. And unfortunately, even though this story served its purpose, anchoring the modern series as a quality program, quality successor to the classic series, The Unquiet Dead does get forgotten about in most conversation. It's the third episode of the modern series. It's overshadowed by Rose, by The End of the World, by Bad Wolf, Parting of the Ways, Dalek, Father's Day, so many great stories in that first series, The Unquiet Dead, it gets forgotten about. And it shouldn't. It really shouldn't. More so than the first two stories of Series 1. And probably more so than any other story in Series 1. The Unquiet Dead captures classic Doctor Who. Not perfectly. Not at all. But it makes an attempt to capture classic Doctor Who. And for the most part, it succeeds. And this is important because the classic Doctor Who fans are the people that Russell T. Davies needs to win over. He needs new fans, obviously. It's a reboot of the series, a soft reboot, but a reboot nonetheless. And you don't need to see classic Doctor Who to enjoy modern Doctor Who. But for those that really enjoyed classic Doctor Who, for those that were disappointed that the TV movie was not picked up and made into a full series, to win them to your side, to get them to enjoy the new series, you couldn't ask for anything more if you're Russell T. Davies. And I'm not saying that The Unquiet Dead does that. It doesn't. But it helps to do that. And when you think about Series 1 as a whole, you have your throwbacks. I'll consider The Unquiet Dead a throwback. Dalek, a regeneration. And then you have your new modern Who twists. The Time War. The Last Time Lord. Romance with a companion. Sticklers may be hard-pressed to accept these changes. So it's the throwbacks that help them to accept that this is just how Doctor Who is going to work in the modern era. It's how Doctor Who is going to go forward. More of a romp. More of a, I don't want to use the word romantic comedy, but more of a show that resembles something that could be mistaken for a romantic comedy than a straight science fiction television program. I don't think I have enough respect for Mark Gatiss. I really don't. Just the fact that he's always writing a story for Doctor Who, and I'm never excited about it. And that he's kind of a doofus. I think I let that prejudge him as a writer when I wasn't familiar enough with him to make any judgment at all. I'm not changing my stand on Mark Gatiss as a Doctor Who writer. He's not a strong writer for this property. But he's very familiar with the character. He knows what he's trying to get across, and he will make a solid effort to do that. And in the end, even if you don't like it on the first viewing, there is repeat value, and when it all is said and done, Mark Gatiss's Doctor Who stories, they aight. What do you think, Adric?
I didn't realize it would be that difficult to control.
Well, you know what? That's great, Adric. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Please click subscribe. Tell everybody you know that enjoys Doctor Who about our podcast. That's great, Adric. Please leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Store, wherever you can. Help spread the word. Please check out The Princes That Were Promised, the podcast that tears apart Westeros and sifts through the pieces. I'll talk with you guys next time. Goodbye.
Pushing the wrong buttons. Atcha-patch.